They were high school sweethearts that got married and had two kids. It's the Brunettes. From a new location, they tweet all day, but that's okay. They're the Brunettes. She is a journalist. He is a wonk.
Wonk, wonk, wonk.
They talk about the news or whatever they want. In the fight for justice, they're on your side. You can't deny it's the Brunettes.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back to our low-effort, low-quality podcast. This is Liz Brunig. This is my husband, Matt.
Hello, everyone.
It's been a minute since we spoke. I was just now reviewing that Matt has posted himself on It's Just Banter, so you have received content.
They got that, and also Crystal and Kyle. We're actually right on time for 1 week from the last time we posted. So in between the two very normally scheduled episodes, they also got over 2 hours of bonus content with me on other shows.
So
they're just killing it in content right now.
I was just observing one of the patrons said, I really appreciate it that you specify what is bonus content.
Mm-hmm.
And you always do. You're very carefully accounting of what is owed content per the contract. And specific bonus content.
I don't
content.
Want people to feel like I'm cheating on them.
You know,
or, you know, not, you know, I don't want that. I'm basically like, oh, here's some stuff I did elsewhere. We're not going to do an episode this week.
Yeah.
You know, because that's something you could do.
You're very conscious of the deal that you've made.
52 eps. Normal eps. That doesn't include socialism series or bonus content. All that's just extra.
You have such an exacting mind, you know. You should go around forming little systems and rules everywhere.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You're always systematizing your practices.
It's important to do that.
You know, everything becomes a little habitus, you know.
Yeah, and then you build it, and then you improve it.
Yeah.
You improve it. That's what's nice about it. If you're kind of chaotic, but if you go, and it doesn't have to be perfect the first time. That's the trick of life, okay? The first time you go at it, you try to systematize it, but you know the system's going to be not really working all that well.
Yeah.
But then you look at it, and then you make a little change, okay? And then you do it again. And then you see, can I make a little change? And then, you know, by the time you're on version 20 or whatever, it's really humming, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I would, if it were me, if this were just the Liz cast, I'd be like, yeah, this is my Patreon. This is just for people who want to support sort of my artwork. So I'm going to put like some narrative nonfiction on here, maybe some fiction occasionally. I'll do my podcasts and my appearances somewhere else. But if we go a week or two because I'm just running ragged and I really don't have anything, that's fine because some weeks there will be like a ton of content because I'm, you know.
I think it's flourishing. Okay to not necessarily have it out every 7 days, but it does need to add to 52 at the end of the year. Or that's you're just not keeping up your end of the bargain.
Yeah, and you would immediately form this systematic way of thinking about your obligations and duties.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a good explanation of our differences. Anyway, I saw an interesting, speaking of moral philosophy, one of the other things that we posted on the Patreon was the talk that I was a part of.
Mm-hmm.
This is the talk on forgiveness, the panel it was on for Baylor in Washington.
Mm-hmm.
It was cool. I got to go back to our old stomping grounds.
Oh, yeah.
Washington, D.C., baby.
I like D.C.
It's where both my kids were born.
Mm-hmm. They're going to get, when they get older, they'll get the D.C. flag tattooed on them.
Oh,
and they'll make
God.
That a big thing. They'll be like, I'm actually a D.C. kid. They'll like retcon that into their identity.
Mm-hmm.
That's a thing you're allowed to do, even if you only lived there for a year, you know, but if you were born there in the MedStar hospital there, you can be like, yeah, but it's just me and my blood, though.
I don't know. Jane, you know, she wants to participate in her school's multicultural night.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. That's a good
day. That was...
yeah, we get this flyer.
Yeah.
And, you know, they always send it up We want to try to keep that noise.
I'm sorry.
It's all right.
I'm just messing with the chords. I shouldn't be.
They send a flyer home, and then all sorts of other, channels, emails, text. It's always all fronts, which I kind of appreciate, actually. But it says Multicultural Night's coming up. Yeah. Sign up if you want to set up a little trifold and display your culture.
Yeah.
And of course, it's just kind of like, it's the same thing. Didn't they have a thing where you're supposed to dress up as your culture or something at some point? Remember that?
Yeah, yeah. You could do all kinds of things to sort of provide an experience of your culture. You could do music. You could do a dance performance. You could do traditional dress, an art or craft.
And it's always like, I'm not really sure what they intend for me to do.
And food.
What is my...
Yeah, I don't know.
Can I just bring some burgers and some dogs?
Look, could you please just write on there, white people are intended to be an audience here. Or do you want the white children to try to participate? Because I don't want...
Do they need to pick like a European identity and go that way?
Or are they just supposed to be like, I'm a white American who's from this region in the United States, which is my culture. Like I'm Texan. We're Texan people. We come from Texas. That's kind of our culture. Here's some of our food.
You came up with that. You came up with that strategy, which was a good one. Ultimately, I would have just been like, I don't really know.
I think here's my principle. This is just a personal belief of mine. My family, they're big into this thing where they're like, look, I got a 23andMe and it says I'm, 64% British or whatever. We're British. We're an English family. We have all these English traits. I don't subscribe to that shit. My family said my whole life, we're English, et cetera, et cetera. Dude, I lived in the UK for a year. That is a completely fucking different culture. Completely different people.
Well, culture, because culture is a different is a different word than gene. So even if you believed in the gene part, which I'm skeptical of myself, I don't think that would get you out of it. Though it would be funny. What if you just did a little trifold and you just put up your 23andMe and then just had
Elizabeth Warren, a
candy from each of the countries, but it was like proportional. So you had kind of like a big circle, and it mapped on to the circle, like the pie chart,
Yeah, I mean, that's...
Wouldn't that be neat? It's
certainly, I mean...
Just be real literal about it.
It would be unclear why I should be mad about this. Like, it wouldn't be obvious what to be mad about, but it would just be kind of unsettling. It would be weird,
Yeah, it would appear to be an imminent critique of the whole exercise.
It would be...
Like, I'm doing this on the inside, but I'm doing it in such a way to make it clear the absurdity and the contradiction of it.
If I were, walking through the place, looking at the projects, and I got to this one, I'd be like, oh, this one is Matt Brunig's. Yeah, this one is, it's okay, all right, yeah, technically within the rules, but not at all in the spirit.
But I couldn't do it because I'd never participate.
So we got this flyer, and of course Jane is just a child, and so she's just simply excited and wants to participate.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so I'm like, all right, my principle is we're white Americans. We've been in the United States. Our family has been in the United States for literally hundreds of years. This is according to my family's own dumb genealogy.
Mm-hmm.
And that's more than enough time to just become fully acculturated and assimilated to a place. We're just white Americans. It's its own thing. Being a white American is its own culture, ethnicity, race, whatever you want to say. All right. And you got to accept it. And then, you just figure out, look around you, what your culture is. What part of the United States are you from? What's your local culture? A lot of white people just feel like they don't have one because they're just kind of acculturated into the global kind of capitalist consumer culture. But I don't know. I mean, I feel like we come from a region that has its own thing going on.
But here's the weird thing, right? So I think you're right that ultimately what you're allowed to do is talk about regions in the U.S. But the kids were not born in Texas, and they've only been to Texas for,
Texan,
2 weeks in their whole life.
Yeah.
Maybe a little bit more than that. 2 or 3 weeks, maybe total.
Yeah.
So what does that mean?
It just means that a lot of people who contributed DNA to them are buried there.
Mm-hmm.
And that means something to us.
Not to me, personally, but...
I mean, yeah, well, what means shit to you, honestly, besides a big, hefty welfare check? Not to put it too point,
Yeah, we could. What if you did like a display that was your region's like welfare state?
Yeah, then I think you'd be getting really, you'd really be stretching it, especially because this is a goddamn elementary school.
You could talk about how they haven't expanded Medicaid in Texas.
Yeah. Okay. Like, just be like, yeah, we're from Texas, the worst fucking state in the union, and just rip it to shreds.
That would just be one of the three of the trifold.
You'd be like,
would be the welfare
has
state.
Has an expanded Medicaid, which proves a point that Matt needs to be true for some of his ARGs.
No state income tax. You know, just kind of list the interesting idiosyncrasies.
Number of people sentenced to die per year, notably higher than other states.
Death penalty. You guys don't know anything about that up here. You know, you're not doing that anymore.
You guys don't have it. So.
So you're coming up with great ideas, too.
I mean, I think what I'm actually going to do is, and I don't know if this is the right thing to do. Like, if I was like, okay, Jane, you can do it. I'll just sign up and say we're from Texas. And I'll make like a Texas sheet cake, just a chocolate sheet cake, right?
Treats. Children love treats.
Everybody likes treats.
Oh, adults do, of course.
And it's not an offensive cake, and it's definitively associated with Texas, and it's just, you know, whatever. Everybody likes a piece of chocolate cake, all right? Now my kid's participated, and she's happy. But I want to write on the little form, like, tell me if this is not okay or if this is not in the spirit of things, okay? Like, vibe check me, because I don't know the vibe. Like, I don't know the people who are organizing this, and I don't know how to vibe check myself, but I am nervous about that.
Well, I mean, I'm sure it's going to be fine, because all they really want is for people to participate, because then there's an activity and there's a way to, like, kill a night with the kids, like for the elementary school. Like, I've gone to so many of these events, and it's all just the same thing, which is just, what if we all kind of got together as volunteers and we made it to where there was something fun and free for kids to do one night?
Yeah.
That's basically the whole bit. Yeah. And then their themes are almost just kind of like after the, you know, just kind of a secondary question.
Yeah. Jane's school is, I mean, I think she's the only white person in her class this year. So there are lots of kids from actually a big array of backgrounds. It's not like this is a majority white school weirdly doing a multicultural night.
Oh,
like,
yeah, yeah. No.
There's actually a big diversity of cultures.
The district itself is majority Latino.
So, like, it's legit of them to do a multicultural night, because there's actually multiple cultures there to represent. And so that's why I feel kind of weird about introducing Jane into it. I don't know if that's intended.
But it's also regular people. It's not the kind of people that you would meet in D.C. who have decided to kind of make their life about, you know, how they can maneuver in politics by claiming the mantle of a specific identity. And so I don't think they give a shit at all, you know?
Yeah, no, that's true. That's true.
Regular people don't give a fuck. They also, regular people, they think it's cool when you cook their culture's dishes.
Yeah.
They're like, oh, awesome.
Oh, you like this too? Cool. Yeah.
But yeah, it's only the insane asylum of like internet and then a few political enclaves where you can cultivate some personalities who care about these kinds of things and think that there's some insensitivities to be tiptoed around. But
Freddie DeBoer had a piece entitled "There Is No Alternative to Cultural Appropriation," and I did not read the essay because I felt like the title pretty much gave you the argument. And I'm like, yeah, I mean, it's hard to argue with that. It seems difficult in the United States, especially, to get around borrowing things from other cultures, because that's so much the point of liberalism.
I actually love reading stuff about cultural appropriation.
It seems to become so instantaneously difficult to manage.
It's impossible to manage, one. Two, you also, there's nothing anyone can do if you just ignore it. Right. So that's always a fun position to be in. Like, there's really nothing. I mean, I guess you could say that for a lot of things, but in that case, really, literally nobody really cares enough, you know, like, so as long as you're okay with people tweeting some random shit, like, no one's going to fire you because you, you know, wore a hairstyle or a certain clothing or, you know, like, that's never really on that level.
Yeah.
But then three, there's never really like a clear, what I always love to see with this stuff is when you're talking about a culture, you're giving credit to a massive group of people, but all innovations you know, they don't arise from the entire group of people at once. You know, there's like
it's true.
There's like a billion Chinese people, and like whatever thing you're saying, like that's a Chinese thing. Like there had to have been a person or two people or whatever.
Yeah.
And so why didn't they all just appropriate from that person? Like there was a great article I read not too long ago where they were trying to, it was one of those ones where they're like, I'm going to show you Marxists. Like I'm a Marxist, and actually there's a Marxist case for this kind of stuff, you know?
Okay.
And they trace the outlines of, I guess like hair, like braid, like I want cornrows maybe. It was one of those kind of braiding things that became popular like 20, 30 years ago. Right. Mm-hmm. And then more recently, you know, there were some white people who were doing cornrows or whatever, you know, I think it was cornrows. And the piece did this like historical grand sweep, and they were able in the piece even to identify like the individual in some city in some salon. They are the one who came up with the cornrow.
Oh, cool.
Right. And it's a black person. And then they're like, so this is. And any white person who uses it. And I'm like, wait a minute. At the point at which you have identified the inventor.
Yeah.
Then all the black people doing it are copying from from an intellectual property perspective. That's the person. And then everyone's appropriating from them.
Time you do the hairstyle, you should have to pay that
guy.
You
got to give them a quarter every time you do a cornrow, regardless of your race. Because, you know, they should have patented or something. I don't think you can patent hairstyles, but... I always thought that was like a really funny slippage there to immediately be like, so wait a minute, one black person in a hair salon in Philadelphia or wherever it was, and now 40 million in the U.S., and now it's like property, quasi-property of 40 million people who did not come up with it.
Yeah.
But not the remaining 260 million in the U.S. who also did not come up with it.
Yeah,
because of the is it the what? But can men? Why would black? Why not? Why not just keep it to at least black women? Because it was a woman, as far as I know, if I recall the piece. So maybe it's only the 20 million black women who get it. Why do also the men get it? She's not a man.
It's true.
And we could just go on and on with this game, but
no, it
and does it extend to non-American blacks? I mean, do we draw a line there, or is it okay now for? Black people across the whole diaspora in Africa, now the cornrows belong to them as well? Or how does that go?
Is it delimited by nationality? Yeah.
So
well,
stupid.
I mean,
obviously stupid on its face.
Yeah. 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 I mean, it becomes very difficult to manage. I've always thought it was funny, you know, cooking as much as I do, that recipes can't be like copyrighted.
That's true.
Patented.
And Richard Stallman used to make a big point about that.
And it's like, that's the government's way of being like, nah, we're not going to get into this bullshit. We're not going to even get into this because...
We're not going to tie the courts up trying to figure out who came up with what.
Yeah, we're not going to fucking start dealing with this because you can argue until you're fucking blue in the face about who came up with the exact recipe with this secret ingredient or this perfect variety of whatever. And it's just not the court's business to get into that. And like, you know, that's kind of what a lot of the cultural appropriation stuff reminds me of, especially because the origins of so many things, especially when you think about styles of cooking and eating, are so unclear.
Yes.
And they're routinely obscure. And even when they're quote unquote known, they're known as far as anything in history can be known, which is... Well, we suspect, we believe.
Yeah.
You know, but the origins
you try to
are...
trace as best as you can. But something like that, because there's so many people who independently cook, hundreds of millions of them, it becomes very hard to trace. It's not like an advanced machine part or something where you're like, well, there's only like three factories in the whole world that could even possibly come up with this. There was actually, and this reminds me of this documentary called, I think it was called Who Let the Dogs Out?
I remember that documentary.
I was quite taken with it.
Yeah.
It's from 2019, and funnily, the name also works because he's trying to figure out who came up with Who Let the Dogs Out.
Yeah.
Because that's that song. I guess I should play it.
I mean...
Is there anyone who hasn't heard this song? I feel like that's probably... Oh, this one is titled Original Version, but in fact, if you watch the documentary, you notice that that's not quite true. Who let the dogs out? Anyways, the guy tries to trace down, because there was all sorts of IP litigation related to this. Mm-hmm. Because did they copy from someone? And who was the first person who did Who Let the Dogs Out? And this guy spends, like, it seems like 8-9 years running this down. He even runs down some old, like, tapes that were for a very specific kind of audio thing. And he had to go find one guy in Europe who still had the ability to decode it with his computer, because he built, like, a custom drive and all this kind of shit. Anyways, at the end of it, despite all of the excavation, you're kind of left saying, I don't really know.
It's unclear.
Who came up with it. And there were lots of, like, other things, because they were saying, he would even show, look, there are hundreds of articles of people talking about high school football teams chanting this decade plus before the song even came out, because that would be like a little hype thing they would do. They'd, especially if your football team was like a dog related thing, which of course there's probably hundreds of them.
Yeah, bulldogs, huskies.
Yeah, so it'd be Who Let the Dogs Out, and then everyone who you know, and bark and all that kind of stuff. But then there were people that preceded that, but then you don't know who actually saw any of that. It probably was independently invented multiple times.
Yeah,
and you know, the litigation. It's quite a mess, but that's something that's a little bit more identifiable, you know.
It was right, it's in recent history.
Recent, and there are tapes, and there are news articles, and it's still, he's like, I'm a Who Let the Dogs Out collector. He's got a whole, like, little museum in his house for Who Let the Dogs Out.
This dude's so troubled.
He's a Who Let the Dogs Out autist, 100% he is.
He's a Who Let the Dogs Out completist.
I strongly recommend the movie, but... he's unable really to run it down at the end of it. And I guess that then leads to this kind of philosophical conclusion of, like,
turns out to just be unknowable.
Yeah.
Because, you know, probably lots of people, as you said, independently generated.
Yeah. Or if they copied, what element did they copy? And, you know, there's just dozens and dozens of potential leads. But
all art owes a debt of gratitude to its predecessors, right? Because all artists are reconstituting the artwork they've seen in various ways, just because you're trying to create beauty. And so you're relying on beauty you've seen.
Yeah, people are running into this question with respect to the AI, especially the art generating AI is the one that make pictures, which I guess is where they're at right now, though eventually the suggestion is they'll make music and other things like that. And it's interesting to watch people on the fly kind of struggle with this question of what's going on with these guys. Because there's one inclination to be like, well, they just kind of fed this AI, you know, this computer program. They trained it on millions and millions of pieces of art, you know, hundreds of millions of pieces of art, pictures and paintings and whatever. And then when you tell it to do something, it's kind of just mixing and matching stuff that it's seen, that it's processed through its system. And some people are like, isn't that kind of plagiarism? Isn't that a violation? I mean, if it contains, you know, if each thing contains, like, essentially 10,000 copyrighted works within it, at least on some level, because, you know, it's not creative on its own, then what's going on there? But then, of course, the counter is, well, how is that different from any other artist?
Yeah, yes, exactly.
Is that not what you're doing when you paint your thing?
Right, or you know, you sit down to write, you have the voices of all these other artists in your head.
Yeah, and I mean, it's true, I guess, of anything, and I mean, it reminds me of how we started this, I guess, the episode with, like, iteration, right?
Yeah.
The way you learn, especially a new thing, is you copy everything that's kind of come before.
Yeah.
And you copy it and you learn all the ways that they do it. Like, if you're learning guitar or whatever, you just learn a bunch of songs and you learn, or programming, you learn how to write a lot of programs that have already pretty much been written before. And then maybe if you're a real innovator, at the end of all of that, you can combine all that with a spark of creativity to come up with something new.
Yeah.
And add a little bit on top of the body that you've memorized.
Yeah. Yeah.
But even that's going to be mixed with stuff you're drawing upon.
Yeah.
So it's going to be 1% maybe of the total composition, you know, it's going to be something fresh.
Yeah.
and then the rest just perfectly executed copies.
I wanted to talk about, I wanted to basically answer someone who sent me an email on the podcast. But if you watch the forgiveness panel, or even if you didn't, because I'm going to explain it.
Mm-hmm. And you can watch it on 2X if you need some time.
Yeah, no worries. I'm talking about forgiveness, and someone asks me, how is it compatible with vengeance? Does it mean vengeance is always and everywhere? Does the goodness of forgiveness mean that vengeance is always and everywhere related to injustice? So that it's always unjust to seek vengeance? And the answer is no. It's not always unjust to seek vengeance. And we know that vengeance itself is not unjust because God says vengeance belongs to him. So it appears that vengeance is one of these things that has its place within certain parameters, but people are very prone, perhaps, let's say, to original sin. And therefore, because of that, they tend to misjudge the parameters of appropriate vengeance. And therefore they go on quite a long time or quite over the limit of what appropriate vengeance might actually be. Therefore, God reserves it for himself, counsels forgiveness for us. But that doesn't mean vengeance itself it produces a state of injustice. It can actually be and appears to be critical for justice, just not really in human hands. So forgiveness is one of these entirely human-specific things. But jealousy reminds me of vengeance in this way. And I was caused to think about jealousy recently because I saw that NPR did an article on compersion.
Mm-hmm.
This was a word that Gordo mentioned, I believe, on our show in reference to Jerry Falwell Jr.
Yeah, I do remember him saying it. I remember not knowing what it was, but just being like, that's all right. I'll just move on.
Yeah.
I don't need to know everything.
You know, that's how you remain good in the world. And I immediately knew what he was talking about. Compersion is it's an attempted piece of moral philosophy. I mean, it's the idea that, you should have joy in others' joy, the idea of taking pleasure in the pleasure of another that you cannot partake of yourself. It's sometimes described as a state.
Here's what it says on Wiktionary. Coined by the charista community in the 1970s, possibly derived from the French compère, plus shin, denotes the practice of brothers-in-law sharing wives observed among Tupi people of the Brazilian Amazon. And then we have, that's the etymology. And okay. Then the dictionary definition is vicarious joy associated with seeing one's partner have a joyful romantic or sexual relation with another. The antonym is jealousy, it says.
Yes. And so this is very important to this word's being, right? Is that the antonym is jealousy.
Mm-hmm.
All right. But you can't just do that with words, right? You can't just enter into the universe of language and be like, yeah, this word has an antonym now. It's this thing, which is joyful delight in the joyful delight of your partner as they engage in sex with someone else.
Mm-hmm.
No.
That's called cucking.
I mean, no, that is not the opposite of jealousy. Jealousy is its own fucking concept, and it applies widely and across the board, right? You don't just get to create an antonym and then give it this silly fucking definition. These ideas, they exist independently in their own realm, okay? And just calling something jealousy's antonym doesn't mean you've actually created something that is in any way responsive to the characteristics of jealousy. We can say that you're jealous of your child's love, right? If a kid likes the other parent, this is common in divorces, right? You have a jealous parent over a child, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
You can have jealousy over your friends who you can have jealousy over wealth. You can have jealousy over all sorts of stuff. To be jealous is to desire, quite covetously, honestly, what is rightfully yours, or quite covetously, typically, because this is another one of those not quite vices, similar to similar to vengeance,
mm-hmm.
In which, you know, there's an exercise which is fully just, which is why God says he's a jealous God.
Mm-hmm.
But there's the human capacity to fuck it up as well, which is magnificent. So humans are kind of counseled against it because it tends to manifest as pure covetousness. But if you're actually jealous over what's rightfully yours, in our culture, we simply don't call it jealousy. So if you're someone who's getting cheated on and you're not happy about it, because you desire what's rightfully yours, what was agreed to be given to you, your partner's, you know, monogamy, faithfulness.
Mm-hmm.
People don't call you jealous. They're not like, oh, quit being so jealous, you know, mm-hmm. jelly much, bitch. No, they recognize you as rightfully wronged here, and your desire is justified. And therefore, we don't call it jealousy, but that's just sort of our mislabeling what's going on, right?
Yeah, it's one of those words whose pejorative meaning has taken over its total meaning. Quite a few.
Many such cases. Vengeance maybe being, one of those is a case in point as well. But with the case of jealousy, I think it's especially problematic because it obscures, again, the sort of philosophical role jealousy plays in describing these emotions people have that correspond to their moral feelings, which are really important. They turn out to be really important in how people conduct themselves in life. I mean, these emotions motivate a huge amount of human behavior. Jealousy over what's rightfully yours, either excessive jealousy that just manifests as covetousness, or totally righteous jealousy, which, you know, sends you on, you know, your life's journey. These are big deals anyway.
Sure, yeah. And I mean, you know, it seems like it would just become an area of contestation where people are going to fight about, you know, whether the thing that conjures up that feeling is justified or not.
Well, and that'll be really the whole debate. Jealousy is like, it already kind of has an antonym philosophically,
mm-hmm.
which is the concept of charity, mm-hmm. right? Like you already have this concept of generosity. Right. So jealousy would be to desire what is rightfully yours, and charity would be to desire, you know, to give, to share what is rightfully yours.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I mean, this already exists in terms of, concepts in philosophy. They didn't need to create an antonym for it because it already had an opposite philosophical practice or concept. I mean,
Oxford gives us admiration,
the opposite of jealousy. Okay,
pride, I guess, like being proud of someone.
Yeah,
trust, understanding.
Okay, I mean,
unconcern.
Yeah, just not caring, I guess.
Yeah, and carelessness.
Yeah, I mean, these are all different than feeling jealousy. I don't know if they're antonyms, but. You see what I mean here? You see why maddening this is, that people can just assert that this concept they've invented is opposite to a concept?
Well, people love when you coin new words or
this concept exists.
Yeah, and when you coin new phrases.
Yeah.
That is like a way to be seen as an intellectual innovator, because there's like a new substance there almost. Even if you're like, oh, well, that's actually the same thing. Like, I've talked about this before with the concept of equity, which has completely taken over the NGO world, right? Where they have this, what they describe as an alternative to equality. It's this thing called equity. But all the difference, there is no difference between the two. It's just that, when you're talking about equality, you have to define equality of what? Are we trying to, not just equality of opportunity versus equality of outcome, but also things like what counts as equal when you're talking, like what is the unit of equality?
Yeah.
Is it going to be resources? Is it going to be regard? Is it going to be, you know, some people be extreme with sexual partnerships? Is it going to be,
you know, Rawls will say it'll be primary goods. Sen will say it'll be capabilities, Dworkin, you know, on and on, right? There's this whole egalitarian literature about what is the thing, right? It can't just be dollars, probably. Or if it is dollars, like dollars of what? Income, wealth, consumption. Do we need to account for disabilities and whatever? And all equity, all the people who do the equity thing do is they find someone who's using an approach to equality that uses a unit of equality that they don't agree with, and instead of saying, I don't think that's the appropriate unit of equality. I think this other unit is the better one, which is a debate that's been going on forever. They go, see, that's why I'm not for equality. I'm for something else called equity. And equity means, and then they just go on to list equality, but with a different unit.
Yeah.
And it's like, I hate it. I absolutely hate it. Every time I see it, I hate it. And it's like completely consumed. Like, Matt Iglesias always likes to make this point. Literally the day before the 2020 election, Kamala Harris on her Twitter account, like her team, posted some video that was like equality versus equity. Like that's how, like the VP, the soon to be VP, the day before the election.
Yeah, that's fitting though.
And then like that's just straight out of the NGO world. And like everyone, you meet people all the time, everywhere, at all times, especially if you do the work I do, who are constantly talking about this. And like, I'm just sitting here just like, this is fucking crazy. You guys are, this is dumb. There's no value added here at all. We have a whole debate here about equality of what, that's been going on for decades and decades and decades at least.
Yeah.
And but if you give it a new name, you give it a new life. And it's the same thing, honestly, with a lot of the MMT stuff, where they just took concepts that have been around for 100 plus years and just kind of phrased them differently.
Yeah.
In like provocative ways, often using words in idiosyncratic ways that are like a little bit misleading. And then boom, like you have an explosion. Like it, language just gets people, just grips people in ways that like the changing and mixing of concepts does not.
Yeah.
You know, you can way more succeed as an intellectual innovator by just using words differently or coining new words than you can by coming up with new concepts.
Yeah.
Like,
it's true.
Simple as that.
It's true.
It Do you sucks. Know the, I was curious because it says in that definition on Wiktionary, the Carista community.
Yeah.
You know them?
No.
Carista was a utopian community that was started in New York City in 1956 by John Peltz, Bro Judd, Presmont. Throughout much of its history, Carista was centered on the ideals of polyfidelity. So.
Great.
There you go. They had something called Gestaltorama. It was a group process. It consisted of a lot of conversation in groups, and you were meant to maintain personal resolve on the lifestyle, a euphemism for being aligned with the social contract, which was a daily task for many Caristans. Being unresolved on the lifestyle, even momentarily or temporarily, warranted immediate gestalt and possible expulsion from the family or commune. Practically, a member could be called out on any standards violation or non-utopian thought or action by anyone at any time.
It's not very utopian.
They apparently started a business in their cult.
Selling what?
Selling Macintosh computers, Macs. This was early on, you know, and they would help you set it up and stuff. And that business ended up being having 250 employees and $25 million of revenue a year. And it kind of tore the cult apart.
Oh, wow.
You know?
Yeah.
So just when you think, oh, they've solved the issue that a lot of the cults have, which is how do you get the money in?
Yeah.
Which is, well, we just create a business selling and installing Macs. And then the business just got too successful. And then it kind of created tensions, you know?
Yeah.
But,
well,
not enough compersion.
Not enough compersion.
Even though they invented the word.
Yeah.
But I guess they don't apply it outside of sex.
Yeah.
You know?
Whoops. That classic problem.
I love every time you're reading a thing about a new cult you haven't heard of, and it's always just like, when are they going to get to the weird sex shit?
Yeah, you're like, what's the wacky sex shit?
What's the sex stuff?
Is it just pedophilia as usual? Or?
Is it just the usual pedo stuff? Okay, oh, you got that one with the flirty fishing ones? That's always a real novel one where they're like, oh, we send the ladies out and they're hookers for Jesus or whatever. Like, that's interesting, I guess.
That's wild.
you know. But this one was just, well, we just all fucking suck each other, you know. Like, it's kind of basic.
I interviewed a lady who had been a sex worker in Vegas for a long time, who mm-hmm. ran an organization called Hookers for Jesus.
Oh, maybe that's what I was thinking of.
She was cool. Yeah. You know, since we're doing the big moral philosophy episode, people wanted me to read and respond to ContraPoint's video on envy. Now, I don't watch videos. I miss that generationally. I read shit. I watch every movie I watch with subtitles on, and I prefer to read it. And I honestly read a lot of scripts for the movies that I really like. I prefer a transcript of every video. But fortunately, ContraPoints makes transcripts available. So I went and read ContraPoints Envy, and it's very long. You know, apparently on YouTube, I don't know, but Matt says people like the long videos.
There is a successful form of YouTubing. I wouldn't say certainly not the peak, but it is a way to be successful on YouTube.
And I don't know much about ContraPoints either, except that she seems nice and like a professor.
I think she was a grad student in philosophy, maybe got a degree. I'm not totally sure.
Yeah, and that at some point people decided that like she was responsible for all the evil in the universe. And I saw that happen on Twitter.
Oh, well, that happens with
presumably it was bullshit.
Every notable person is the thing.
Yeah, yeah. If you're notable enough, eventually you become responsible for all evil and harm. But, you know, she never caused me any problems. So I read it. It was quite long. My understanding is Matt probably did not read it.
I'm going to try to get ChatGPT to summarize it here.
Oh, great. Yeah, tell us how that goes.
It's a little finicky sometimes.
I thought it was good. I thought it was interesting. I mean, she's a great popularizer of philosophy, right? She kind of takes an intellectual historian's approach, and she has a very good style in terms of integrating real world applications of the ideas she's coming up with. You know, she's not dealing with ideas that are so abstract they're kind of hard to think about, like ideas and language and so forth. She deals with a lot of psychology and the sort of human character, which I also do in my work, and I also find it very interesting. And it deals with a lot of art and literature as well, which I think is important in bringing in. I think it's important to bring this into philosophy because it's obviously just such a significant expression of humanity.
Mm-hmm.
It's wrong to cordon it off and exclude it from consideration. I really like Elaine Scarry, who I recommend all the time as an author, because she does so thoroughly evaluate art and literature in her writing. And what's fun about ContraPoints is a lot of this is contemporary pop art and literature, which I find to be pretty fun. I think, you know, I have a basic disagreement with ContraPoints, and it's summed up here. And this is kind of a critique that runs against a lot of the stuff I've been talking about in public recently and even on this panel. She says, there are Christians, maybe not most, but still some, for whom love and forgiveness are genuine experiences and not just some kind of twisted, impotent, passive-aggressive vengeance. Where I agree with Nietzsche and with Freud is I do think a lot of the emotional foundation of justice and morality is retribution, envy, or some combination of the two. Now, I mean, I think if this is true, this sort of Nietzschean read on Christianity being a religion for people who are incapable of asserting their desire to vengeance, right, and therefore have to sort of sublimate it into a desire for forgiveness. This is sort of Nietzsche's read on Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where he's like, not being able to take vengeance transforms into not wanting to take vengeance, which is forgiveness, essentially. I think for Christians, forgiveness itself is a virtue that people aspire to. It's possible to aspire to something quite genuinely and not live up to it. I think this is a problem for subjects in our era, because the things we aspire to so closely align with our expressions of identity. And so if we don't fully embody the things that we aspire to, or if we can at least project an image of it, it feels like it's failing to do its job as an identity signifier. But it is still worth aspiring to things that we can't live up to. And forgiveness, especially in the Christian tradition, I think, is one of those things. And I think that forgiveness is generally catechized in that way, or taught that way in churches in general. And I do think it is something that, you know, when people are capable of it, and I don't see, you know, I see forgiveness distributed kind of evenly throughout the population. I don't see it as being exclusively Christian by any means. I think it is something that is sincere. And I think, especially in this day and age, the pressure to forgive is so limited. I really don't think it's strong enough to, warp something into a kind of passive-aggressive, vengeful forgiveness, right? Because people have the option to just not forgive whatsoever. That's a perfectly amenable option for a lot of people now. So, you know, I have my doubts about that reading of Christianity. And my issue with people who say, well, Christianity, you know, with its, you know, sort of sublimating forces, turning all of these natural human urges into these misshapen desires towards meekness and humility and, you know, so on and so forth. Don't you think at base, a lot of this is just retribution and envy? I'm like, well, if that's the case, you know, if justice movements, if things that seek to, you know, uplift the oppressed are in fact, evil in that way, then this is true of like all justice movements, right? It's not just true of Christianity. This is true of any anti-oppression effort. I mean, it's true of civil rights in that case, right? I mean, and so aside from bloody revolution, any justice effort that attempts to persuade basically all of liberalism, and Christianity included, strangely enough, because it also attempts to nonviolently persuade.
Mm-hmm.
All of these are going to be interpreted in the worst light possible. But I mean, yeah, I can't follow Nietzsche to that place, because I think that's historically been a pretty fucked up position to occupy. This is where Nietzsche becomes most available to the, you know, exploitation of, I think, some of the worst political figures of our time.
Mm-hmm.
So, I liked it.
Oh, all right.
I have that disagreement. I have that departure where, you know, I'm obviously an explicitly Christian idiot, and ContraPoints is not coming from that point of view. So obviously there was going to be some departure, but I thought it was interesting. Did you get anything out of ChatGPT?
No, they said it was about Fire Festival.
Oh, no. What did he say?
He just talked about Fire Festival and Instagram influencers and stuff.
Oh.
Which, I mean, I guess it is. There was some Fire Festival stuff in here, so.
Well, he got confused.
Yeah.
I imagine like a little robot typing.
It's kind of what it looks like.
I know. That's cute to me. I don't want to imagine it as just like the ghost in a computer. I want to imagine it as like a little robot sitting down at a computer.
Yeah, they need to add that into their like interface. Is there should be like kind of like, you know, like Clippy.
Yeah, I love Clippy.
A version of Clippy.
Yeah, man, I should get Clippy done on my nails. That would be fun. There was a little bit of a hullabaloo on the Twitter.
Yes.
This was about someone who tweeted the following tweet. I would like to be able to ride the subway with my four-month-old baby and not be in a car with people smoking.
Mm-hmm. Fair enough.
Now, the reason I'm no longer on Twitter...
This tweet got 4.3 million views, 624 quote tweets, 248 retweets.
The reason I'm no longer on Twitter is because this woman got fucking dragged.
This is Mindy Iser?
For a completely reasonable, normal-ass take. What the hell?
Yeah, there's just been this thing brewing around transportation in particular.
What the hell
like
is
especially
going on?
Public transit, where it's like, it's almost like you're watching people spin themselves up into these really crazy positions. And,
why?
And I guess because it's kind of niche enough that it's not of great concern that there's no one to like pull the brakes on it and be like, that doesn't really make sense, guys. But yeah, no, I guess like a large counter reaction was saying that it's actually really bad for you to say that people shouldn't smoke
on the subway.
That would be, some people immediately go to, and I always love this move because it always strikes me as a troll move that like a libertarian would do to like screw with you or like a conservative would do to try to poke holes in your intellectual edifice is they're like, oh, well, okay, so you want less smoke. You know that means more policing, right? I thought you get to police. I thought you get to the police. Hmm?
Yeah.
And that's always where they go. And you're like, that would be a great move for Tucker Carlson.
Yeah.
You know, to kind of be like, oh, wait, I thought you were anti-police. And yet, you want to make it illegal for me to emit pollutants into the world. Yeah. Curious, who's going to enforce that if not the police? I guess we're allowed to have pollution. Or you could go on and on. I mean, smoking is an example where people are willing to like, well, what if people just like piss on the subway and shit on the subway? What if people punch people on the subway? kill people on the subway?
Okay.
Sexually assault people on the subway. Like, point are we like, you shouldn't do that? And I guess yes, but you know, hopefully you just don't. Like, we get it across that just don't do that, maybe. And then I guess if for some fucking reason people are real insistent on it, then we have to have people down there to make sure it's not happening. You know, like, I guess hopefully it doesn't come to that point, but you know, if you, for whatever fucking reason, you cannot wait to smoke your cig. You know, I guess we can't have other people smoking your cig. Like, that's part of the issue there. Not everyone wants to smoke your cig. So that's why we create these rules to where you smoke the cig where other people don't have to smoke your cig, you know?
Yeah. I don't know. I think, you know, I'm falling into this. I was talking to a lovely Zoomer friend the other day, and she goes, you know, God would have ruled to live in the 90s, something along those lines. And I was like, oh, it sucked. I mean, you know, I remember the 90s, and it was a lot of like, you know, torturous abuse. It was like, you know, you're getting fucked with at school and at home. You got big fucking Coke bottle glasses.
That's the whole issue there. In any kind of like prior era, there were some people who things were going better and some people who things were going worse.
Fucking like we're going to help in fucking Kosovo. And
like your childhood was a bad childhood, at least as, you know, experienced at least large parts of it. And so... You go, well, that was my childhood, so that was a bad decade.
Yeah, like, but it's like, I mean, yes, the teenagers who, like, called you a piece of shit and told you to fucking get out of their way were wearing combat boots and flannels, and that was kind of cool, I guess, instead of whatever the hell they're wearing now.
I struggle with any kind of personal decade analysis because... The life is so different.
Yeah, it's incomparable. The phone really transformed everything.
Well, there's that, but I mean, just if you're comparing it to your own life, it's like, well, how do I compare a 10-year-old to a 20-year-old? Like, I'm just doing so much radical. And then even now, you think, well, yeah, but now you're in your mid-30s, so you've kind of had some years of consistency, and it's like a couple, I guess, but not really, because now I'm in the have young kids stage, which is completely comparable to anything that preceded it. So how do I even know,
You know, I would need to be able to go through the same life stage at the same point in time.
It's crazy what's happening to us right now, too, because, like, these are probably the most exhausting years of our lives, but emotionally, you just have two people who do nothing but, like, beam love at you. I mean, they're annoying and they cry.
They do other things than that.
But they love the hell out of
they
you.
They do, they do.
They're... And, like, that's what will fade. Like, they will go off and love their own families and stuff, but, like, in terms of just, like, someone going around with a Sailor Moon-style heart-shaped laser beam, just shooting love right into you, that's mm-hmm. what they do. And that's probably coloring this era in you know, prism and rainbows, making it kind of beautiful. But what I was saying is just that, you know, not to be like an old person who is like, you know, things were better when I was little, but, like, in 2010, I feel like the world was pretty... All right, yeah, secondhand smoke is not good. You don't want to smoke in front of the babies. You don't want to blow smoke in a baby's face. You don't want to smoke if you're pregnant. Like, I feel like we were there. And now, for some reason related to, excuse me, police brutality?
Yeah, well, yeah.
And prison abolition? We're going to say that, yeah, there's, you know, the secondhand smoke is fine for the babies. Like, come on.
People run into these, yes, people are running into a problem where they don't like police abuse. They don't really know what to do with it because, you know, or even they want to go really all the way with it.
Yeah.
But which, then it's like, oh, but there are a lot of practical problems that that would create. So you can't, like, go all the way with it. You know, look, I thought you were using the slogan to refer to, like, for instance, the people on the subway who make sure people don't smoke. They don't need a gun. They yeah, could just they like a wear gun, a yeah. fucking high-vis vest and be like, hey, cut that out, please.
Yeah, I don't think that it needs to be a lethal altercation at all.
Yeah, you know, like, there's that thing, and then you know, if you're clever enough, you'd be like, and that's essentially the abolition of the police, because to me, what it makes the police is all of these X, Y, and Z characteristics that the, you know, person who, you know, for instance, the meter maids and stuff, we don't even think of them as police, even though they right. are engaged in law enforcement. There's, like, that element of it, which I thought, that's where I kind of thought people were for a while, but then you have people who... And then they just wind up in these situations where you're like, okay, so what do you do about this problem? And they're just like, I'm going to hold to it and be like, yep, you just got to deal with it. You got to inhale smoke that you don't want to inhale, even though it's carcinogenic. Mm-hmm. You get, if someone yeah. comes up and just starts like pissing on you on the train, you just got to be like, well, at least there's no police.
Yeah.
Because if I were to, you know, if we were to say you can't piss on other people on the train, then you'd have to, there'd have to be an enforcer, and I can't have that. So I guess we just have to be pissed on in the train.
I remember a bunch of right-wingers got mad at me back when I was still on Twitter because I said that the guy shooting heroin on the train, remember that picture that circulated?
Yeah.
I was like, this is mainly sad, and I'm sorry your kid had to see it, but, you know, it's mainly sad. It's not a danger to you.
Right. Well, and at least the person who's shooting up heroin is not getting yeah. it into you.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm not saying that should be yeah. tolerated on the train either necessarily, but there is at least a difference between one or the other because there's no secondhand heroin.
But it just seems to me that there is a way that unites both positions. That, like, look, we're not trying to throw people in jail here, nor are we trying to have sort of lethal confrontations with the cops, but we do need to limit the misuse of public spaces.
Right. Well, and part of the, and part of also is just, look, you can't, policing is not actually the way that you get, like, overall compliance with pro-social behavior in society, because you don't have enough police to do it, right?
Yeah.
It's just not really plausible to get the kind of coverage yeah. you would need to, like, police state you're into it. So part of what you do is you just make it known. You have to create social expectations and express to people their social obligations, which would include, especially if you're just kind of a normal person, we're not talking about someone who's, like, out of control, whatever, wait until you're off the train to smoke your cig.
Yeah,
like, we all expect that of you. And if you can make sure people understand that's the expectation, a lot of people do it. I mean, that's how they essentially solved the littering problem to the extent that they did, right? It was a kind of public campaign to be like, hey, you really shouldn't just throw your trash like on the ground and shit. You should put it in a trash can. And you know, litter used to be a massive problem. People forget that because now things are relatively clean. But I mean, it just used to be fucking trash everywhere. People would like drive down the road, and if they want, when they were done with their fucking burger or whatever, would just throw the wrapper out the window. you don't see that a whole lot anymore. But you know,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Yeah. Now there, and then also there's these like elements of this that are really weird. And so, I mean, one of the main responses was something like, short of using a private car for transportation, what you're asking for here is more policing on public transport, which just use a private car if you don't want to deal with the public part okay. of public transportation. So they're defining the public part of public transportation as not that you entering into the public need to behave in a pro-social way because it's a public space, not a private space where you can do whatever you want, right? But instead the opposite, that when you go into a public space, you're expected to tolerate any kind of antisocial behavior, right? Like, to my mind, I always would think this is exactly the opposite. If you're someone who wants to smoke, then you should ride in a car.
Yeah, right. Because
then, fuck, who cares? Like, yeah, it's just you riding in a car, box, no yeah. one's bothered by
it. Go for it.
And then the only thing you could say is something like you'd have some kind of public health, and then you would really get into kind of like, should yeah. we infringe upon people? But in the public, you're not supposed to do that.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not like, if you want to avoid cigarettes, you have to have a private
Guys,
car.
Guys, we went through a whole thing about cigarettes in public, and it turns out they give you cancer.
Yes.
And so that's why we don't do that anymore.
Yes. Like, and I mean, they give me migraines.
Yeah, they, you know, they're really hard on some people, and they give you cancer. You get cancer from them.
Right.
Well, you die.
Flight attendants used to get it. I guess he's saying, no, it's okay if in a plane, I guess they're yeah. saying you could ban it, because he's like, that's not public. Of course, that's real funny, because it's just that's the distinction. We've kind of arbitrarily decided that. Of course, in lots of countries, they have public airliners, so yeah. I don't know if you count. For whatever reason, like the bus and the subway, those are like, people think of those as just like categorically different than any other kind of transportation or any other kind of public space.
And I just find the tenor of this critique so bizarre, because like a friend of mine is working on the Hill right now, and she told me that right after the Republicans took over the House, they made it within the rules to smoke in there again.
Mm-hmm.
Like, are these people left people who are coming after her being like, no, yeah, we want to smoke in there.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. Yeah, we definitely want to make legal smoking in public spaces.
Well, it's like, yeah.
What the hell? This public health effort was fucking progressive.
Well, there was, of course, the tweet that said public health is actually a capitalist plot to make healthy workers that can be better exploited.
I mean, yeah, they got you there, man. They're trying to give you a long life so you can work for them. So what do you do to get back at them? Kill yourself. That is so fucking stupid.
The entire concept of public health just exists for the bourgeoisie to have a reliable, low-maintenance labor pool and for the military to have healthy recruits. This is the best sentence I've ever read. There's a reason the healthy foods in school drive was concurrent with Iraq.
Okay.
Just baked. It's a brain. It's just totally bush at this point.
And I mean, it really wasn't. It was Iraq was concurrent with the years of Sarah Palin taking trays of cookies to schools to offset what Michelle Obama was doing.
No one was ever concerned about kids being healthy before Iraq.
Yeah, no.
A relatively low engagement kind of thing. It's not like yeah. at any point they're like, we're running out of troops for Iraq, like fucking Vietnam or something. Like, we're well past that point. That's not how wars go anymore. They don't just land 5-10 million people in another country. It's fucking airplanes and, you know, remote artillery and shit. Like,
they told Michelle Obama to fight childhood obesity so they could have more blood for the blood god.
He's like, you know, I noticed something. About the same time the war on terror began, Laura Bush was really pushing literacy.
Yeah, just...
Do you think it's because they were figuring, look, we need to have more literate soldiers, because if they're more literate, they're going to be better at soldiering, you know, because they'll be able to read all the stuff and the instruction guides, and it'll be a lot easier to train them up. So I'm just saying, she was really pushing the book shit,
And it's kind of suspicious.
Melania wanted you to be best because that one's harder to account for.
I don't remember. Oh, hers was anti-bullying.
Anti-bullying, be best.
Weird, you know, here's another thing, you know. They were trying to make it less bullying because they didn't want people to kill themselves, because when they kill themselves, they can't do war.
Yeah, that's
war.
The thing. This philosophy you've got going on just points in the direction of killing yourself being the only way to revolt against the capitalist pig. I don't know if I can get on board with that.
This thread is just full of just the most insane tweets. But there is an element of the left that's real into, like, you know, it's just the kind of like people who do punk shows and like that kind of shit. And so I think for them, like, smoking, there's like a countercultural aspect to that where they're still playing. It's kind of weird because you're like, dude, it's not fucking 1997. Like, what are you talking about? But there's still some people who kind of hang on to that. You know, I always think about like the denim jackets with the patches and shit like that.
Yeah,
and
but
like,
they're hanging on to the same thing like Grover Norquist is hanging on to. You and him can get together and talk about how cool it is to smoke a big stogie.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
What the hell?
Well, yeah, they're doing it for, you know, separate reasons or whatever.
Like, no, mine looks cool.
Yeah, mine's about masculinity and freedom, and mine's about being counterculture and a crusty punk. Yeah. It's like, oh, okay, cool.
Don't smoke near the baby and light up when you get off the train like everyone else. Good Lord.
Let's make the public things nice and let people do garbage in private areas. The public needs to be the top tier option.
Yeah, let's not just shit in the commons. How about that?
Yes, keep the commons nice. Everyone act nice in public and then save your garbage for the private areas.
It's the opposite of how Americans behave.
They take it the exact opposite.
They shit in the commons and then save their decency and then, their private life.
Yeah, and then the idea is you're supposed to tolerate that.
Yeah.
It's like, no, this is public. It belongs to everyone. It does not belong to you. It belongs to all of us.
Yeah.
If it belonged to you, you could do what you want. It belongs to all of us, so we have a say in how we want to run it. That's what makes it public. It's the collective running of it, as opposed to an individual running of it. So you must follow the collective rule, which is don't fucking smoke and go do your individual shit elsewhere.
And people got so mad at this woman. This is just a random person tweeting she didn't want the people smoking around her baby on the train. And you have like blue check journalists going into her timeline, finding her talking about COVID and how she doesn't mind that, you know, whatever. She's already gotten it. And you know,
you have you have all sorts of, like, this is one that you would be familiar with, I guess, a little bit, but, there were all these extra threads that weren't even like necessarily linked, but, there's what I actually think is going on here. She spent years catering to class reductionist dirtbags who like that she gives them semi-clever rhetoric that's shallowly politically correct but ultimately undermines feminist liberatory work on the left. So this is, okay, so there's thousands of other subthreads where people are obsessed because they think that she represents some kind of anti-feminist position. Who fucking knows?
God almighty.
Now that she's in the highly vulnerable, isolating, and difficult position of being a primary caretaker for a young infant during a pandemic. Another one.
Okay, all right.
Yeah, this is all, just throw that in there. Like, does she self-identify as caring about the pandemic anymore?
I don't know. No, she does not.
Most people don't. So I'm just saying, you might be a little bit reading into it. Most people don't really care about that anymore.
Most people consider that period history over.
She's furious to find that, the informal feminine labor she used to minimize is actually exhausting and overwhelming. So she's going through the horrific experience of trying to navigate the burden of early motherhood and challenge of primary caretaking in COVID times, again, the COVID times, while managing cognitive dissonance of finding out the bullshit she peddles not just harmful, but harmful to her. So she's actually just learning that she's going through the problem where she was very much against like feminist ideas, and that now she's really, actually, the feminists were right. That
now, this
being
is like,
a mother
this
is hard.
Someone
and it's
hexing you. This
exacerbated like by COVID,
someone,
by the way.
When they make up like an alternate past and an alternate future for you that's worse, that's them hexing you. You've just got to like pray that, you know, God protects you from their evil will.
This shit happens all the time. And you know what? This is a great,
you know, I'm going to actually probably remind you of this thread in the future.
Yeah, I know. Because it's such an analog to people would be like, oh, I get it. She's just XYZ. And they'd have this whole theory. And I'd be like, right. This is just dark.
But
man.
Then
this
also to point out
is malign.
That there are these full blown ass theories of people's states of mind that are completely detached from reality about someone who, no offense, who?
Yeah,
who is this
Mindy
person?
With a flower.
You know, like, this is not a writer. I'm not saying that makes you, but you know what I mean. Like, this is a regular ass person.
This is not someone who is like a public figure that you could reasonably get away with defaming because, you know, their reputation is public property.
Just a normal kind of, you know, I do social media and there's like communities of people who have whole theories of who they are. And it's just like, you got to recognize that stuff in your menchies, a lot of those people are just fucking out of their mind, just
and
completely
you have,
out of their
like,
mind.
But you had legitimate people responding angrily to this woman, which is just...
Sure, sure. But that one was a little bit beyond the pale.
Which is just madness to me. I mean, like, what the hell did she say that's offensive? Why would you get involved? I don't know.
They just have decided, you know.
A website is a strange place, man. People get into some strange thinking on there.
All right. Well.
Well.
You know.
I'm a nasty woman.
Oh no!
Remember that one?
I do. I don't know why she did that accent. I'm glad she did though.
I'm a nasty woman.
Yeah, me too.
I am a cisgender millennial who's been diagnosed with generalized anxiety disorder. I used to struggle with imposter syndrome.
Yeah, that's me.
Those are the three kinds of women.
Yeah.
You've got.
I am a cisgender millennial who's been diagnosed with generalized anxiety disorder.
Yeah.
I used to struggle with imposter syndrome.
And?
Come on, nasty woman.
Those are the three options.
There are three broads.
On my soundboard.
There you go.
And then this.
It was so raw.
Yeah. God, that girl. Yeah.
And you. All right. Anyways, thanks All for right. listening.
Thank you.
Got the content out. Here's Rick Perry for you.
Love you.
Adios, mofo.
Bye.